you know, this is why I'm doing this. I think it's a great, great cause, because people in the West, and particularly over the last 50 years, death has become so sanitized. People are so disconnected from it. They don't even know how to react to it. We've lost the skill of grieving, I think. I've got a crash course.
I just want to see the same things you can see, understand the meaning on a new degree.
This episode is a little different because Neil and Sangatara are complete strangers. They're not complete strangers. I know each of them separately, and they have crossed paths, but have never meaningfully spoken or met. So I was, I don't know, not nervous, but I wasn't quite sure how this conversation was going to go. All the other ones are people who knew each other, who were coming there knowing fully well, like, who they were meeting and who they were talking to. And what transpired was something that I think is really important for people to witness. These are two people who are comfortable with talking about death and dying and grief. It's a part of their lives in different ways. And they each bring different personal experiences of loss and beliefs and thoughts around death and dying. But what it represents and what it shows is how deep you can go, even if it's somebody who you've just met, because we have this shared humanity, we have this shared experience of losing people, of living a life that we know will end at some point. And they go deep pretty quick. And I think they are, I mean, I find them fascinating to listen to. I think they're both great individuals. And together I was like, oh, okay, great. You know, when you match people together, you're like, you're my friend and you're my friend. So I hope you really enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Again, gremlins, I apologize in the beginning. The microphones are messed up. I did my best to try and match it, but hopefully it does nothing to take away from the conversation that took place. If you are interested in some of the other episodes of Talking with Mortals, please like, subscribe, do all that good stuff. You can get your own deck of cards that they use in the conversation if you want to use this with somebody else. Maybe a stranger, I don't know. Maybe you're inspired. Always with consent. Make sure that they know what they're getting into. But yeah, do what you can if you want to support this project, if you like what we're doing, if you like, you know, the effort that has gone into sharing these moments and these thoughts. I believe that it's really important. The people who are involved believe that it's important. So if it's important to you, then do whatever you can in your capacity to kind of spread this, and hopefully we can make more. So without further ado, please enjoy this episode, and thank you for watching.
Maybe that could happen when you're next to me. I just want to see the same things you can see.
Yeah. Hi. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Great, so it's a scene. We've here, we'll talk about death and life. So, if you wouldn't mind, describe your first experience with death.
The first time I remember seeing a dead body, I was quite young. I was about, I think about 8 or 9. And it was in Ireland. My whole family was Irish. And my father, I was in someone else's home, but my father came downstairs carrying, I think it was his auntie, who died. And he took her downstairs and they were laying her out. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was part of I realised later on, I wasn't scared. Everyone else acted like it was completely the most natural thing in the world to do. And they laid her out. And it's very much part of that healthy tradition where the family prepared the body. Mm-hmm. The woman of the house washed the body and prepared it for burial. And it was part of the grieving process. I didn't realise it at the time. But because they were very relaxed about it, I wasn't scared at all, even though it's a dead body, because my dad was fine, and it was like, this is what you do. Mm. So my first introduction was quite a healthy one, in a way. But it just shows you how much children react to how adults behave, the vibe they give off. And ironically, years later, I did spend the time, again in Ireland. I lived in Dublin for 2 years, and I was doing semi-nursing duties. And I used to take bodies to the morgue, and I was completely fine with it. Some people are completely freaked out by it, but for some reason, maybe it was that first experience, or maybe it came from more ancestral. But I've always been really okay with all of that, not scared of it. And it's been the same since losing my my parents have passed away, and also my late wife as well, unexpectedly. So in a way, that kind of prepared me more to face it full on. So yeah, probably about 9 or 10.
Mm.
How about yourself? Do you have a memory of your first experience of death?
I feel also quite young, even though I don't remember seeing the body. He uncle dies. Maybe the first person that died around my family was, he was 33, and he had a seizure in the toilet. I remember just more like my mom springing into action, and like more like solving things. And that's actually, I just remember internally understanding what happened quite quickly, and I remember just like there was a bird that landed on my windowsill, and I thought, for some reason, I thought, oh, that's kind of my uncle. And I just kind of let him fly away. Don't remember very much before or after, but I just remember kind of the bird and me trying to even kind of consciously say, oh, yeah, kind of, and off you go. But I don't remember seeing his body, I just remember that moment more. I must have seen. Even though in Mexico, there is a, most of the time is close coffin, kind of.
Coffin?
But also, actually, funerals in Mexico happen very quickly. So, like, someone dies in the next few days.
Mm. Okay. What do you take most for granted in life?
God. Gave you that question? I mean, probably so much, but probably health. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things, like, every time I get a bit ill, it gets like silly ego from like, oh no, that's not. My normal is not to have this. I consider illness to be an exception to the rule, which is, anyway, as a Buddhist, we kind of, you try to take on the truth that old age is a thing, we age, that we get sick and that we die. So, those are kind of quite common reflections or acknowledgements, kind of quite basic.
Mm.
And even though being quite a core practice, I do notice when I get ill that I'm like, this is not normal, I should go back to normal, this is an exception. Which means I keep up on just health quite a lot of time.
Yeah. Okay.
Probably at the moment, I mean, it's funny because probably the things that we actually give for granted we're actually not aware of until we lose them. At the moment, I think I probably give for granted the freedom, so many freedoms I have, both of
expression, you know, like being in a free country where you could,
yeah,
I could be a Buddhist, I could do, you know, we're not being bombed, you know, there's so much, you know, the peace that we experience, I mean, at least physical, you know,
yeah,
psychological is probably slightly different, but yeah, just so many other freedoms and being able to be involved in the projects I'm interested in, you know, I think I do have quite a lot of freedoms, even though I don't have money, I'm actually so rich in so many ways. So so probably something that I don't reflect on. I kind of I acknowledge, but I don't. Yes, I probably don't. Probably give for granted a little bit.
Well, it makes sense about the health. As they say, youth is wasted on the youth.
Yeah.
You know, you don't realise what you're missing until it's taken away from you. And my dear old Irish mother used to say, old age doesn't come alone. Meaning like, yeah, you just don't get old by it. Other stuff comes with it.
Mm.
And I think health is the one that's... you can be a billionaire, and it means nothing if you're in pain and you can't get rid of the pain, they'd swap it for anything. So yeah, I think health's a big one. And the freedoms as well. I'm quite shocked that I've been brought up in a time from the 60s onwards where all the kind of liberal revolution happened in terms of, you know, various freedoms and acts of parliament, that, you know, to give people status, people who were oppressed before. And you can see now in America, it can be rolled back like that. So that maybe that last 50 years was a blip and we're going back to. So the freedoms that we take, I was part of the whole liberal, you have, you know, 1967 Homosexual Act and abortion rights. And you think, yeah, that's the way it's meant to be and that's the way it's going to be. And you see now in America, and it's coming over here now, they think that could just all disappear. So
yeah,
I get that. Shall we?
Yeah.
I think we both talked, haven't we?
Bit, yeah. What do you think is the biggest challenge people your age are currently facing?
My age. I feel quite. It's a good question. I feel quite strongly about this because I'm going to be in a few months. I'm going to be 68. So I think. Because of the breaking up of the families, where it's been centre of communities and so on, extended families and people being broken up into more individual units, I think older people are not valued as much. And I think people have got an inherent fear of getting older because they know that they might end up bringing up children, but, you know, being widowed or, like I'm a widower, or end up living alone. And not being valued by society, rather than the kind of classic notion of elders of the tribe. You know, because I've got a lot of life experience and a lot of knowledge, and I'm continuing to kind of, you know, get involved with as many things as I can because I want to be able to share some of those things. I have a 15-year-old son. My son's 15, so I was an older dad. That keeps me young and keeps me current, and he plays me all the latest music and stuff like that. And I see old age for me because of coming from a spiritual point of view as well, where you leave the householder aspects of having a career and bringing up a family, that final quarter of your life, again, go back to more ancient communities. This is the time when you put those things aside and prepare for death. This is your time to become more deeply spiritual. So to me, I'm quite excited about it. I see it onwards and upwards, rather than a slow descent into the abyss, which I think a lot of people feel, because if you don't have that spiritual aspect, and also, you know, you're identified very, very closely with your work identity. This is why people drop dead after they retire.
Yeah.
They go, first of all, the stress catches up with them because they finally relax and they go, boomf. And also, who are they anymore? Mm. And very often the family unit's broken up around the world, and people are going, well, what was the point of all that? Mm. And I think too, when people get married or have a relationship young, they think, right, okay, the deal is, okay, we're having our kids young, but later on there'll be a big payoff, you know, because we'll have time together. Then maybe a partner dies, or, you know, you're made redundant, or you're on the scrap, and you think, you become ill, you know, you retire, but then you start having illness and you never have the chance to travel, and it's a gamble. So for me, I think the biggest problem is that people feel like they're not going to be valued. And I think it's true. I think older people have a lot to share, a lot of wisdom to give, but there's no forums for it, except, you know, they're tidied away into an old people's home, but they're all talking to each other. But there's not that, unless you're a grandparent and you're involved in with the younger members of the family, then a lot of that wisdom goes in the scrap heap. I think that's the biggest problem. It's becoming harder to keep that wisdom within the family, within the community.
Mm. Do you have just one son?
Just the one son, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I want to ask you, well, both... well, because you mentioned that now twice, your later wife, your widow, and yeah, I don't know, just and that you've gathered some wisdom in your time,
yeah,
that you want to share. So I guess it's just the opportunity to value in that experience of What was your experience?
I think that, unfortunately for most people, they don't really wake up to their own life, and like you were talking earlier about appreciating health or appreciating freedoms and stuff like that. People just trundle along and even get a bit bored with a kind of regular life, and they don't wake up until something bad happens.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a sudden health problem that endangers their life or someone they love. It can be someone they love dying or being involved in that. Sometimes it's not until then, and suddenly people start praying to God out of the blue, start going, oh my God. And then suddenly going, oh look, butterflies, and isn't life precious? And suddenly they're sitting in the garden going, God, isn't life amazing? They don't wake up until something drastic happens. For some reason, when I was younger, I kind of knew that and thought, I want to wake up before something bad happens.
Yeah,
I feel like I've got an awareness of maybe some deeper stuff, then in that case, it's on me to stay awake as long as possible. Mm-hmm. But then again, when I lost my wife, it was just unexpected. She was only 48, and it was kind of a very short, quick illness, and she died quite quickly. Mm. It was a real shock. Mm. That's still... You know, I tried to be awake as it was, but that kind of just puts you into a different, a minute-by-minute survival thing. And that changed my life because I had left television, become an academic, to teaching at university, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I did that so I was around more for my son. But when she passed away, that's when I realised that my spiritual practice, and particularly my meditation practice, became like a fucking superpower.
Yeah.
You know, people hear about meditation and they think it's some kind of, what's about like, you know, a mini day out at the spa, kind of relaxed and chill, nice towels, you know. It was a lifesaver, because when you are, you know, projected into a life-changing experience like that, I'm left with a 10-year-old son, and suddenly it's me. I'm 14 years older. It was always meant to be me. It's going to go first. And she'd be around a long time for her son. And she took care of so many, many things. Then suddenly it was on me. So I found myself in the middle of it. And because I was able to meditate twice a day, I was able to bring the thoughts down a little bit. Because, you know, you have this, you know, tsunami of thoughts coming in when you lose someone so close to you, practically, emotionally, and so on. And because I was able to do my meditation, it meant that, as you know, and people meditate, that anxiety and stress is all based on worrying about the future. Mm. And I had a lot to worry about practically. all this coming over the hills like a bad, you know, cowboy movie where everyone comes over the hill and standing at the top coming towards you, think, oh, here we go. So if I got lost in that tsunami of thought, I'd be swept away. And then looking to the past, I had regrets. You know, everyone argued during COVID. So I remembered all the arguments we had. Why did we have those arguments? But we were soulmates. We loved each other very much. So I forgave myself for that. And then beyond that, you've got all the happy memories. And they're all sitting, coming to. So I'm in the middle going, oh my God, if I fall this way or that, it's going to come and crush me. So through my spiritual practice and meditation, I was able to, hour by hour, just deal with this hour, sort out the funeral, book the priest, whatever it is, get through day by day over the broken glass, through the furnace of it. And what this protective bubble that came that didn't stop me being crushed, the future and the past, in your mind, the mind torturing itself. Mm. I had that peace of mind twice a day. I was able to get sleep as well. I still was grieving very deeply. Mm. And things hopped over from the future and jumped on my back, and I had to wrestle them, and I was upset and I was grieving. And I'm not saying it was perfect. But I needed to be okay because I had a 10-year-old son. But deep down I knew I was going to be okay. And that was because of my spiritual practice. And that's because also I knew my wife was a very pure, good soul. And that wherever she was going, because I believe there's something more, she's going to be okay as well. And that was a very powerful I knew either you fall into the abyss and it crushes you, and you hit the bottle, or, you know, people take a lot of drugs and alcohol just to calm the chatter down in their heads, just to get some peace, you know. And I like a drink still, you know, and so on. I'm not squeamish about any of that. But I actually went weirdly into about 4 or 5 months where I didn't take anything like that. Because I knew it would just get me messed up, emotional and kind of like, oh, they're messy. And I thought, I've got to face this head on. The old expression, the only way out is through. And because I went through into the heart of it, I came outside a bit quicker. And I know people since then who've, relations of mine who've lost people, and they're still grieving. It's taken them years because they've gone round the long way. And it keeps on coming back to them and so on. So that was completely transformative. Either it transforms your life or, you know, gobbles you up and you lose a decade of your life to just be messed up. And I know it's what she would have wanted. I was thinking, I'm here and she's not. And she'd want me to live my life to the full. Because it's a gift to be alive. As you said about health earlier. It's an absolute gift. And we just need to wake up and go, fuck, this is amazing. I'm here. She's not. I need to make the best of this. I make it the best for my son. As a tribute to her. So I miss her terribly, you know. And I miss her wisdom and her laughter. And God, I wish she were here now. Because she was so good at, you know, like a lot of men, I can do one thing really, really well at a time. But she was a real multitasker and she dealt with so much. And suddenly it was all landed on me. And I'm going, what? How am I going to cope with this? But you get through it. But that helped me. That was a big wake up. And I realised my spiritual practice and meditation practice was a superpower. Hardcore superpower, life saving. Not some cool little, oh, it just is my anxiety a little bit. Fuck it, I was like, you know. I don't know if that answers the question. But.
No, yeah. And apart from your spiritual practice, which seems to be essential, more than essential support, like quite a crucial part of your going through that loss, did you have people that supported you? Was any? I was just trying to think of like, whether that's something that you could do. Like, you had your grief process, you have tools to deal with it. But if I would be someone who I can see someone going through it, how can I be helpful to that person?
Yeah.
So I wonder if you find someone that was particularly helpful in that period, what's a good way of supporting someone to going through that?
That's a great question. I actually had not very much support. I think, like a lot of people, you get into a little family unit, and it was like there was people I could develop friendships with through university and work and stuff like that. But it's always like, nah, I'll do that next time. And I had to rebuild my life when I lost my wife, because I kind of hadn't really developed friendships. I've done, and so the last 4 or 5 years since it happened, I've developed a whole friendship group. Again, being in the 60s, a lot of widowers, a lot of men struggle a lot more because they don't have a friendship group. A lot of women have good friendship groups and they survive better. So I had to build that from the ground up. And I had to go through a lot of myself. And in some ways, you know, when people lose someone, everyone comes round to the house, here's some soup, here's this and all. I didn't have any of that. And sometimes that kind of protects people from their emotions, and then everyone leaves, and then people are left to their own grief, and then they collapse. I had to go through it from the start, face on, because I've got family in Scotland and not so much locally and all that kind of stuff. So the big thing is to, I would say, to help people is to acknowledge it. When my son was, when he was okay to go back to school, he was only 10, I went back to the playground, and I used to take him to school in the morning anyway before I went to work, so people knew me. But some people, one or two people would say, I'm really sorry to hear about you've lost your wife. Oh, thanks very much, I appreciate that. And others would avoid me. And I just felt, now I understand why people get a bit uncomfortable, but at least fucking acknowledge it. I'm not asking to help me. I'm just going to go, I'm really sorry to hear about, you know, I remember your wife and all this kind of something. But people just like, don't make eye contact. And like, I think that was quite hurtful. Now, that people are just squeamish. They don't know what to say. But I would say something rather than nothing. Acknowledge it and say, really sorry to hear that. Just basic kind of acknowledge. You're not upsetting someone by bringing it up, particularly if it's just happened. Just go, it's okay, I'm really sorry to hear that. And the classic thing is to listen rather than give advice. If when you're grieving, if you want advice, you'll ask for it. If you don't, you go, well, actually, I think what you should do is this, which is a very male thing. And one thing I've discovered too, being in a marriage thing with my wife, and I've learned not to do it, is that, and particularly when dealing with female relationships, if a woman's speaking to you in particular, but this can apply in grieving as well, it's like offer advice that it gets asked for. If not, just listen. Sometimes people know that, they just don't need to listen, not go, actually, what I would do is, oh, great, okay. So that's the big thing. Don't offer advice unless it's asked for, but just be there, turn up, listen. And if it's someone you don't know so well, at least acknowledge it. Is it a neighbour or someone from through the school? Just go, I'm really sorry to hear that. You know, that basic things like that can be very hurtful, and people just don't even make eye contact with you. You start to feel like a social leper, you know. People can, you know, this is why I'm doing this. I think it's a great, great cause, because people in the West, and particularly over the last 50 years, death has become so sanitized. People are so disconnected from it. They don't even know how to react to it. We've lost the skill of grieving, I think. I've got a crash course.
Yeah.
And I'm warranted on ask for a crash course, you know. So
could a few reflections is enough. Not giving advice when it's not requested.
It's a very male thing.
And also friendships groups, I think. It's also not having a supporting network. I've seen that on Friends where I can see that we're more male friends than to a relationship as their main the main intimate relationship I can imagine what happened to you being quite common.
I should have seen that, but building from the ground up. I built up friendships, people I should have, you know, got to know better. I had got to know better, and you're surprised who turns up. You find out who your true friends are, those that are sticking around for the good all the time, not the good times, you know. And I joined a men's group as well called Mandem. Mandem are a great group, and I went to talking circles there and made good male friendships through that. No, that was really good. And what I discovered was that because I lost the most precious thing in the world, which is my wife, it made me feel this. So I started to, I went to workshops doing improvised comedy. I've been on the biggest quiz show in the UK, The Chase. Apply for that. I've been on that, and I'm going, do you have many academics on here? And they go, no, academics and They don't want to be on TV. Why? Because they're scared they're going to look stupid. And I was like, I don't give a fuck. So I'm just trying. I've tried lots of different things that, you know, because it's like, I don't care. I've got nothing to lose. I've lost the most precious thing. And there's a great freedom in that.
Mm-hmm.
Not taking yourself so seriously. Oh, I'm an academic, you know. And that's what I meant to say. Through that thing with my wife and power meditation, I gave up my academic career to spend more time with my son, because it was getting demanding again. The job was becoming so demanding. And now I gave it up to become a meditation teacher.
Mm.
Just cut to the chase. This works. Help people directly, even more than education.
Mm.
Than teaching them about film and TV. It's a lot less money. I sat with my son and said, look, I'm giving this up to spend more time with you, because the ages between 10 and 18 are so precious. I could grind away working long hours. He doesn't see me and I go, oh, look, we've got all this money. And by the way, I'm going to die. You know, I've spent a lot of time with him, of great quality time. But it was because of that experience I went, right, I'm getting off that hamster wheel.
Mm.
It's too demanding. I've got the prestige, I've got the money, but I junked it all, went, sod it.
Mm.
So now I'm teaching meditation. So yeah, that was because of that as well.
Mm.
And that is essentially my life story since you've asked me. Yeah. Okay.
I think we've got time for like two more questions.
Okay.
Or so.
Right, hang on. Let's get a good one for you now.
Okay.
Oh, it's a good one. Hang on to your hats for this one. A fortune teller offers to tell you exactly when you'll die or what you'll die from. What do you choose?
Oh, that's a good one. When or how?
Hmm.
I reckon I'd go when. I was talking about this yesterday or 2 days ago. Yesterday actually. Yeah, it was yesterday because I went to visit a friend who's dying at the moment of cancer now. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about his kind of potential funeral and
goodness.
Actually, it was a mixture of like thinking about him on our way on the train, because it was unclear, we had to take a long train to see him. And I was with a friend, we're like, oh, I wonder how it's like to know that you're dying and what of. And I thought, well, I could imagine there'd be a freedom of and a clarity. I mean, obviously, sometimes maybe the anxiety of like, oh, you're about to die. Stop existing, or have I done everything I want to do, or the time's now clearly more limited, I know what I'm dying of. And also particularly of cancer with, you know, it's spreading around the body, so it's actually quite physically uncomfortable and painful. But anyway, it's just like kind of knowing that, you know, he's not going back to work. It's more like, you know, go weeks, if maybe months, just to be in bed. And I was reflecting on both, like, oh well, knowing that that's what he's doing now, like he needs to, he knows that what needs to put into place is just like how to die and more than when, you know. And I had this thought, I was like, oh well, if I knew I was gonna die in a couple of months, I would do different things. But that doesn't mean that what I'm doing right now is important to me.
Yeah.
You
can't live your life like you're gonna die tomorrow. You can't live like that. So yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah. But I know that it could happen. I could die in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
But I don't want to start acting as it, because what I'm trying to bring about, you know, I know it's going to take more than 2 weeks. If I know I don't have more than 2 weeks, like,
yeah,
okay, well, I'll do something else. You know, I'll go and spend time with my family. So, But anyway, I think that's what I was talking with him about. It's just like, oh yeah, no, for you it's kind of quite clear that's what you're doing. You know, reflecting about death and how to die and about being with experience and relationships and how to do that. So, but yeah, anyway, that kind of reflection is me acknowledging that both I'm in a period of my life where I'm still creating, trying to create, manifest, yeah, and build stuff under the view that I have time for it.
But you would want to know when rather than how.
I think exactly. I think more when, like a when, because particularly. So if I would die in 2 weeks' time, I think I'd go to Mexico to be with my. Particularly, yeah, I wouldn't want to die. I really don't want to die before my mom and sister, because I think that'd be pretty tough for them. Particularly the distance. Like, I have a life insurance just so if I die, they can come over here.
Oh, right.
Because, you know, I don't have money. So they don't have money.
You've planned that. That's really good. That's
yeah, so cool. I have a life insurance just so there's money
to
facilitate that. I mean, I should be doing more around that, like the trust thing. I have a Google Doc that's called Sangadaris in Death and Illness, where the only thing at the moment is the life insurance code. But my plan is to put there just like what I want to happen, and maybe letters of apologies for dying early, etc. I have a whole plan of what I want on my Google Doc, which I haven't done. But no, that's the beginnings of that. So yeah, anyway, that's just to say, if I know the date, because I want a period of creating these socially engaged and create institutions and projects, but I'd also like to have a period of time where I am exploring that creation and creativity in a more solitary way, like my artist friend at the moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the moment I like, oh, but at the moment, but right now I'm doing it quite socially. I want to do it more independently at some point, but not right now, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I'd rather know in when rather than how.
Okay.
And just because I could potentially plan for the house in the meantime, you know, whether it's going to be a slow, painful one or a quick one. Anyway, I could at least prepare somehow.
Yeah, we do negotiate with the idea of how we're going to die, because the thing that struck me about my wife passing away was, and this is a thing that applies to a lot of people, she went quite quickly. She was taken to hospital and then she went into a coma almost within a few hours, although we got to speak to her, and then she died about a week later. And then I hear of people going, oh, they've got cancer and they're going to die in 3 to 6 months. They're going, why didn't we have that? I actually went to have spent that time with her, for her to think about her life, to her, you know. But then again, I've met people since then, you know. I met an old friend I hadn't seen for years, and she'd been looking after her partner who got a stroke and then a brain hemorrhage. And she was caring for him for 3 years. And that was a slow, agonizing way to see the pair. So there's no good answer.
No.
I would like to have spent more time with my wife rather than just her to be taken away, because that's what they call complex grief. But at the same time, saying, oh, you know, let's have more time, and then watch your loved one being in pain and agony and change physically in front of you.
Yeah.
That's not good. That's difficult. So it's not
that's
easy.
Also difficult. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have time for one more? One more. I wish it was.
Oh, is this from me, right? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Is it? Was that who asked the last one? I can't remember.
Yeah,
I
did.
Yeah, I asked the last one.
Yeah.
It's my best. So it's you.
All right. So last question. I think you've already kind of started answering that question, but I thought maybe allowing you to maybe paraphrase it or go deeper into that answer of a. I mean, you've experienced the loss of your wife. How much that experience might represent also a gift. I mean, there's something when I've lost my best friend, I've experienced it both as the worst thing and the best thing that's happened to me.
Yeah.
So it has that kind of almost like kind of that coincidence of opposites, where it's just like a terrible thing and a precious thing. I wonder if you've had that experience. Well, it sounded like you talked about freedom and you know,
transformative kind of, and all that, yeah. But so I think
it's kind of the gift of death, if you want to.
I think that depends very much on the perspective you already had when it happened. And that if you believe things happen for a reason, or you think things are just random and they're very painful, when you come at it from the perspective of this is meant to happen, there's meaning in it, and you give it meaning by how you approach it, then it can be transformative, and it can be a positive, it can be a gift. For some people, the one thing not to say to someone who's grieving is that, oh, by the way, that's...
Yeah, no.
I think you'll find, from my experience, it's a gift. You know, they can shut the hell up.
Yeah.
So timing is everything, right? But depending on what your perspective is, it's like when the meaning of, say, someone dying when they're young, someone losing a child.
Hmm.
Everyone has an effect, even if they're only here for a few months or a few years. I have this image of someone dropping a pebble into a still lake, and then the ripples go out. So the tragedy of, say, someone losing a child who's only like 5 or 6 years old, they haven't lived a life, you've got a taste of their personality and the person they could have become, and then to lose that child is tremendous. But the death of that child affects so many people. It affects the mother and father, affects the family. It raises questions about the meaning of life and death. And that's the purpose to me. That's the meaning of, if I lost a child, I'd have to find meaning in the child came through us. Khalil Gibran talks about children don't belong to you. They come through you from somewhere and you guide them whatever way you can, but they're a gift. A child comes in for 5 or 6 years and then you lose them. There's a meaning in it, that pebble in the causes the ripples will have an effect and change people's perspectives of life. For some people, it might make them resentful, make them darker, self-destructive. Another person will go, this was a gift, this was beautiful, I need to wake up, I need to appreciate my own life. And that's the choice we all have. Is it a gift, or is it like the worst thing has ever happened to you? So that's what people have to decide.
But what about for you?
Oh, I've come very much from the perspective of if it meaning something. People are here for a while. I have no control over it. Whatever gave us the gift of life, things come and go. The meaning is to stay awake, appreciate being alive, grieve the people you lose, and then live life to the fullest after it. That creates meaning. The Albert Camus thing, the existentialists, have a different view on it, but with Camus and the absurdists, they had this notion of, even if you don't believe in God, even if you don't believe in the source, say yes to life anyway. Might as well say yes than no. Even if you don't believe in anything, life beyond death or God or bigger meaning, his point of view was very much, well, you might as well say yes than no. You might as well be positive than self-nihilistic. And I went through that phase before, when I kind of stepped away from Catholicism, rejected kind of standard religion, which is manipulative, it's controlling, and moved into more spirituality. I went through the whole wearing a black polo neck and a beret, I went through the whole existentialist thing. But that's the thing I like, was the absurdist notion, which is life's absurd, but say yes to it rather than say no. So to my friends who are atheists, I push them towards that, because I know they're not going to go for the spiritual stuff. Lean them towards, you can still say yes to life, you still be positive, even if you don't necessarily believe in some great meaning.
Does that feel like a good place to good stuff.
Yeah.
Do you have any responses that you want to make?
No? Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming to late night spiritualism. On BBC Two.
Baby, you know I just like to talk with you. I just wanna go out.